Join Johannes, a necromancer of some little infamy, and his charismatic brother Horst in the many adventures of the Cabal Brothers on the Necromancer's Deathcast. From circuses to dreamlands in turn-of-the-century never-never England, author Jonathan L. Howard brings his dry wit and exceptionally clever writing to the series of the most intense and tumultuous proportions. Rise up, all ye undead, and rejoice in the wonder that is the Necromancer's Deathcast. Welcome to the Necromancer's Deathcast, brought to you by Free Flow Rambling. This is episode 2.1, Pantomime, where we are discussing the story, Exuant Demon King. My name is Tanzin, and I'm joined by Amber.
Hello.
And Jess.
Hi.
Johannes Cabal, a necromancer of some little infamy, has faced many horrors during his career. But in this tale, he tells of an early encounter with something that horrified even him. Pantomime. A provincial theater has seen a series of strange deaths. The young Cabal investigates, even though this requires him to don red tights, a curling mustache, and become the Demon King. So the story starts out at Christmas.
Which he describes as overly familiar and of ill breeding.
It was quite the pot shot right off the bat.
Offensive right away.
Out of the gate, always. That's awesome.
Happy holidays.
Right? You got to appreciate the not so subtle differences between setting a horror story in the midst of a Christmas setting. You know, always mucking around with extremes.
Reminiscent of, you know, Doctor Who Christmas specials.
Exactly.
It's not quite as horror, but, you know, there always seems to be a murder on Christmas.
Just to ruin the festivities.
Right.
Well, that happens at my house. I don't know about you. Let's talk about family dynamics now.
Right.
It was a cold and lonely winter night.
We see a description of his house stolen from the place that it was and put in the middle of nowhere. And I kind of really appreciate the setting and how it relates to Cabal. Winter delays his experiments as is quote, terribly difficult to rob a grave when the soil was frozen.
So inconvenient.
Damn, I hate it when that happens.
Yeah. So true, King.
I had a question. What do you think analytical necromancy is?
That's I bolded and underlined.
Right? Okay. Yes, I did too. I'm not the only one. I was sort of like, huh, that's an interesting phrase. Analytical necromancy.
Or what are the different types of necromancy?
Fact. Like, and in fact, actually, it was later on in the thing where he talks about he was a necrophologist.
Yeah, necrophologist.
Necrophologist. Yeah. I noted that as well. I'm like, how many necro specialties can one have? Is there a school for this? Can I get my bachelor in necrophiliism or whatnot?
It's almost like when you're trying to like plump up a resume when you've only ever had one job. And it's like, yeah, I was a cashier at McDonald's, but I handled the monetary value of an international company. And I was a cook, and I've also been a cleaner, and I've like.
So you think Cabal, Johannes is just fluffing up his resume?
Well, to a point where Cabal is like, he's really analytical, we saw. Like, he was like doing his own library and Dewey Decimal System in the first short story.
True that.
So I think this man is just like, he's really incapable of just calling it necromancer. He's like, no, when I do this, it's this. And when I do that, it's that. And for us, it's all just necromancy. But for him, he's like, uh-uh. No,
there are limits here.
Today I'm a surgeon and tomorrow I'm a gynecologist and then tomorrow I'm a family doctor. It's like, it's not the same thing. I'm not just a doctor. Every hat is different. Thank you very much.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah. Specializing in many things.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, again, for him, the analytical, I think, just comes, you know, that's less necromancer and more Cabal.
Totally.
Well, and maybe it's because of his view of necromancy, because he looks at it as a cure for death.
The man who attempts to cure a common cold is a popular hero. The man who tries to defeat death is hounded from pillar to post.
Yeah.
That was a great quote.
Well, and his contemporaries are usually doing it for the wrong reason anyways, because they're doing it for power, whereas he's doing it for what he sees as a nobler cause, at any means, of course, including summoning demons.
And he essentially says, like, and even if I mess up, what's, like, a couple of Frankensteins left out around the countryside? Like, essentially, he's like, sure, we all hit a wall, just because mine happens to be dead bodies left in the skewers. That's not fair, like... All right.
But here's the question, and maybe we'll get to this a little later, but like in terms of intent. So I think you and I, Tenzin, were talking about in reference to another story I'd read or another series I was looking into about like the complexity of characters. And sort of, for me, I'm always attracted to characters who you're never quite clear on what their intent is. Like they're not the cut and dry superhero good guy with the white hat. Right? It's like later on and I don't...
Characters written in a shade of gray.
Right? And I don't know if this is like... where is it? There was some notes I made about like how... Yeah, I'll get to it. But essentially it talks about intent. Like he had no intention of disrupting the evil spirit from doing what it wanted to do. Yes, he was just curious.
Just observing.
Right? Just observing. Like, what? This was all a big misunderstanding. But... That, to me, I think it's, yeah.
Yeah, we'll get there.
And sorry, I'm jumping ahead as usual.
No, it's just a funny take again on his expectations of the world.
But also just not, like, for me, it was the questioning, does he have noble intent, really? Is the intent just knowledge, learning, understanding?
Well, yeah, I have another note about that as well.
I don't get that his intent is to save the world.
He's not necessarily, like, an anti-hero. He's more like an anti-villain. Like, he's... Not exactly out here to, in his opinion, he's out here to do better. He wants to stop death. But at the same time, he's a little bit like you know.
Do the ends justify the means,
though? He wants to stop death after death, not really beforehand, you know. Whereas most people are like, yeah, I want to stop the killer in the movie. He's like, no, like, let's clean up after. Like, why would I throw myself in now? It's safer if we come back later.
Reduce, reuse, reanimate.
Really like that about him.
Yeah.
I really like that about him because it gives him growth, room for growth as the stories progress.
Multifaceted. And Christmas Eve, a family time. And we have Cabal all alone in his giant mansion.
Yeah. He was feeling nostalgic, so he wishes the box a Merry Christmas. And then... It starts whistling Christmas tunes.
Aww. That's awesome.
Whatever a Christmas tune is in Never Never England.
Right. And he's not completely alone. I mean, I am totally, like, he's got the thing, he's got the box, the singing box, and he's got things in the garden, in the woodshed, the skirting board things, which is direct reference to the first story.
Right.
I hate to hear that some of them survived.
They're still plotting their property development.
Yeah. But you know, there's a quote in here that says he just can't get many visitors already. It's most of them just don't even make it to the front door
because of the things in the garden.
Exactly. And I'm jealous. Like, I would love it to people not be able to come to my door.
Pets for the introvert.
Yes. Yeah. It's amazing.
You, like, too, can have a vicious garden.
I'm tired of people coming into my yard. I don't want visitors.
That's funny. I have a friend who's an introvert and runs a garden. I'm sure she'd appreciate that.
There, you see?
She'd make some suggestions instead of ordering ladybugs for the aphids. Try some fae. For everyone.
Well, that's another thing is that as we see, the constable comes in, right? And, you know, these garden fae, etc. are trying to cause him problems. And he just got like, hey... These are iron tip boots. Get fucked. Yeah. Don't mess with me, bitch. And I'm like, that is a great idea. And our other podcast about Jim Butcher's The Dresden Files, he needs iron tip boots too. Right? That's great fae defense. I love it.
Well, and here's the question. Like, I noticed that the police sergeant Parkin, when he arrives, he interacts with the garden things. And it's like, there's a familiarity there. So like, my question at that point was, is he familiar with fae in this world? Or is he just familiar with Cabal's household shenanigans?
Right? That's hard to tell.
So, I don't know. That had me questioning, because I'm like, he talks to them as if they're old friends slash nemesis, frenemies.
Well, we know that he's been there numerous times already to get his donation.
Professional courtesy, at the very least.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you just got to get through the thugs at the front gate to collect right. your
And I imagine it might be the world itself that has these things, because it doesn't faze him.
Mm. Exactly. And that's why my question, it was like, is he just familiar with...
Right.
And again, yeah, and is it familiar for everyone, or is it just those in the know can spot it?
Right.
It's another thing, it's not really clarified at this point. This is really only the second person we've ever met in the series, because in the first short story, it was Cabal and...
The demon.
Things.
The
yeah.
Weather
yeah.
condition.
Wind yeah. and skirting board people. Now this is then the first other character we've met. That is a human.
So he's opening his house, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Opening his heart at Christmas.
Happens to the best of us.
Am I getting too deep here?
Well, and I really loved that when they're talking about the kind contribution to the police benevolent fund, that Cabal's just like, I find your brand of honest dishonesty endlessly fascinating, Parkin.
It's a bribe.
Right.
Yeah.
Just calls him on it.
Mind your P's and Q's.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I really like the fact that, you know, the storytelling opens up the narrative to different ways now with the arrival of Parkins. It's like, okay, now we get into the story within the story. I like the story within the story format because it makes it more first person. It's Cabal telling his story, not sort of that third person narrative, if that makes sense.
Right, right. We get right? to hear the character's thought process and voice.
Yeah, yeah. And so in pulling it back into the first person, I did this, it actually is really effective for a reader. Like it pulls you in because you're experiencing it as that character, right?
Hmm.
Because there's a psychological kind of link that is made in first-person narratives.
Again, that passive versus active
exactly.
storytelling, yeah.
Yeah, so it goes from that sort of passive that, you know, here we're just getting a visitor, and, you know, if he didn't transition into Cabal telling the story within the story, it would have stayed all sort of, well, this was in the past tense, and then...
It wouldn't have been nearly as interesting.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what draws you in as a reader. I mean, amidst all the other things that draw you in as a reader, of course.
Hmm. So Cabal invites Parkin to stay for a drink, to which Parkin accepts because he's, again, feeling a little nostalgic and a little Christmas-like without, despite his distaste for it.
And he's offered free booze. That also helps.
Right.
Social lubricant.
Yeah. So once they get comfortably buzzed and move on from a single malt to a cognac... Cabal decides to share a story of his own.
Mm-hmm. And I like how he says, Christmas is a time for ghost stories. I actually laughed out loud at that. I'm like, I don't know about you, but my family doesn't tell ghost stories at Christmas.
I wasn't sure about the next part of that phrase, though, if it was a jab at Jesus.
Which part?
Christmas is a time for ghost stories, and mine has the distinction of being true. Like, whoa. Ooh.
Ghostbusters theme.
Yeah.
But I wasn't sure who the jab at it was.
Right.
It made me giggle nonetheless. Yeah. Like, ooh, Cabal.
Careful, we might have Christian listeners also.
Right? Christian listeners listening to the Necromancy yeah. Deathcast. Awesome! None you guys are awesome!
More likely than you think.
Yeah. None of the views expressed here are.
I think, you know, Christians might be the number one fans of Resurrection ever.
Right?
At least for one specific guy.
Like, wait,
I think that's at least two.
I'm like, didn't at least two of us also attend Catholic school?
Yeah.
Three
out of three. Yeah, there you go. We're all a little dark.
Thanks, around parents. Here.
That makes a whole lot of sense now.
Why are they so speaking of Faust? Yeah.
Yeah, so he actually does describe this as like Faust for toddlers.
Right.
It's like the feeling I got. And yeah, I was like, all right, sure. Let's get into this now.
Totally.
That's an introduction to a Christmas story.
Okay. And so going back to the original thing, like there was one quote that I noted here. There are no career plans for necromancers. One just has to guess, extemporize. And I laughed at that. Like that. Does that not have to do a lot with what we were just saying about that fluffing up the resume.
Analytical, like, necromancy, et cetera, totally. And he gets really mad about it, too. He's like, I abominate death. It's like, all right, good point. That is technically what you're doing.
Totally.
But yeah, it's a very much like disdain for the medical establishment. Like very us versus them. Like you're kind of both supposed to be on the same side. But again, like he'd prefer to do the after part. He's like, no. It's messy and hard at the beginning. I'd prefer to just step in after and
right.
snap my fingers, essentially. Like, we haven't seen what his process is for it, but yeah, he's very... He's got that very much like, it has to be his way. There is no room for change. It's like, no, I cannot do it this way. That's not how it works. And maybe that, again, like, what did he call it? Analytical necromancy. I've got my step-by-step instruction, and I've got when I come in and play my role, and it's not going to be a minute sooner, you know?
Yeah.
So.
Definitely.
So.
And then we get to the pantomime.
Such a dramatic introduction. For the fear-evoking word.
Yeah, using his tongue to evict cockroaches. Enunciating every syllable. Pantomime. I don't know. Coming from a bit of a theater background, I thought that was hilarious.
I had chuckled very hard when I read that.
The Faust for toddlers, as you say.
Yeah, well, and just in case anyone doesn't know, Faust is basically the idea of a man who made a deal with the devil, sell his soul for wealth and fame and fortune, et cetera, that sort of timeline. So...
Sounds like a good introduction to the next book.
So, yeah, like it just seems a little bit of a nod. You know, I can really see the inspiration happening here.
That's a really good point. Mm-hmm. Foreshadowing. Totally.
Well, the author did say that this was the book that really made him be like, this could be more.
Totally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So they realize that Cabal, in his early days in this story, he realizes that there has been 4 deaths in 20 years at the Alhambra Theater. So there has been a recent death, and he decides to investigate. Just as a random other side note, leave it to Johan to describe this, the color of the sky as oxidized magnesium. Because... So why not?
Right? There's that analytical nature once more. Absolutely. And then we get into the... I like the description of the play. When he was talking about within the play, the summoning of the Demon King, and, you know, we're supposed to rise from a platform, the star trap and everything. I like the statement. As an aside, summoning demons is actually a time-consuming and persnickety business. I feel this production seriously misled its audience, but I digress. Like, you really get sort of an insight into his experience and background, and like, yeah, this is laughable, but I'll play along.
Right.
You know? The reality of the situation is much more complex, but okay, let's go along with this.
Right. So as you said, he's got this whole timeline figured out already and has to find the connection.
Mm.
Right? So.
The 2300...
Yeah.
2300 years?
2300 days.
Sorry, yeah. Days. Yes.
Approximately 6 years, 4 months, and a little bit.
So I was curious to see if like 2300 had anything to do with anything. Like, why?
Yeah.
Was that significant in the first place? Because as we find out in the story, we see why there's like, it's reoccurring at that point, but we don't know why the first one was that number. Like, it doesn't say for any reason. Why did it have to be on this day? It never comes up in the story. And I was, like, trying to figure out what the hell was, like, 2,300 days. And all I could find was Bible verses about, like, this, like, essentially it's a story of a ram and a goat. And it takes, you know, 2,300 evenings and days to fix this problem, this sanctuary that had all broken down, and blah blah blah. I'm not going to go into Bible verses, but I was just curious because, you know, the devil is sometimes significant or symbolized as a goat. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to do all these different, and like I couldn't figure out anything about it. I'm like, okay, so you just chose that number for no reason. Like I tried really hard to like make this connection. I was like, it's not working.
Come to find out, it's actually just the code for his bike lock.
Something, right? I was just like,
well, he does mention a little bit later on that the significance being the number 23 times 100 represents the arcane. So it's not necessarily 2300, but a perversion of the number 23. But why, again, was the number 23 chosen? I couldn't figure that out either.
Well, like the Dewey Decimal system. Cabal's got his own systems in addition to the standard known systems.
Yes. So
I did have a good appreciation for the description of the accident. How he describes that. A muffled cry and a sound of like somebody taking an axe to a rotting tree stump.
Really visceral.
Right? That's a great way to describe somebody getting their skull crushed.
Right.
Like, dark. I love it. So Johannes decides to offer himself up as an actor in his... He figured it was appropriate to say that it was true that he was an actor because he had been delivering lies successfully all that time.
Well, and the fact, okay, so my hat's off to him for being able to quote the lines from the script immediately. Like, who can do that? So obviously he's got some sort of crazy, you know, memory. But I had a question on that. Like, okay, so... had he already planned to investigate the theater through like some form of infiltration and thus he pre-prepped and learned all the lines, or does he just have a kick-ass memory and he's able to improv and ad-lib when needed?
I think it is just a kick-ass memory. I think he does just have that.
What is it? The photographic memory?
Yeah, I can't think of the word exactly, but yes. In D&D, it's called keen mind feet. And that's all my brain works on anymore.
Well, and speaking of D&D, I actually saw in the afterword on the E publication that the theater was actually one of Jonathan L. Howard's favorite sort of D&D settings as well.
Yes, he does really enjoy. He said, yeah, and there was like an interview or something like that. He really enjoyed going to the theater, despite the fact that he's never had any hand in it at all.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I find that really obvious, like even in the descriptors, like the way that he describes different things, it's visual. And I think that's what appeals to me in the writing a lot, is that it is very visual, like his descriptions. It's like you can see it.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And that for me is good storytelling. So. Mm-hmm. But yeah.
So we get that lovely exuent demon king moment. It's Latin. It's Latin.
As if Johannes isn't like fluent in it, right? Like
it's Latin.
Yes, I know.
Clearly, Cabal is much more intelligent and learned than many of his peers.
It's not plural. You're supposed to say exit. It's Latin. Some of these plebeians, hey?
Yeah. He also gets into, there was a quote, although this was in my early days and I was not even technically a necromancer at that point, I still had the very mild fortune to meet a couple of demons. And so that also, like speaking on the resume and stuff, is sort of situating us in the context of his current career, which I thought was interesting. And I liked how, like, so So the two demons that he'd already met were either Weasley and apologetic or impressive in its air of wanting very badly to slowly shred every scrap of meat from my bones and eat my soul for dessert. My question in that second one, the impressive in its air of wanting, is that's Bonewind. Yeah? No?
Oh, but he didn't summon the demon. And that's an Eldritch weather condition, not a demon.
Oh, okay. So he's already fought two demons before we even
he's
get
at least
this
met
point.
Them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Hmm. And I would hope so. If you're already going around calling yourself a necromancer, right. I'd hope that you'd have done at least some work at this point.
Some experience and, you know, at least be able to walk into an interview and state that experience.
Well, exactly. And again, like, I understand. Okay, fine. You don't want to write your first short story about your very first day because it was very pathetic and sad. So you waited until experiment 400s to start giving us something. But there should have at least been something in those first 400s, even if you're like, let's not comb through this, but...
Good point.
Right. Yeah,
good
so
point. He's got the chops and the experience behind him.
At least to a certain extent. He is still of little infamy so far. According to perhaps just him. I'm not it's hard to tell sometimes whether the narrator is third person omnipresent or if it's all just Cabal. It's not ever stated, at least thus far, that he is writing his own memoirs. Hmm. It is just little infamy to whom?
Hmm.
So we take a look a little bit deeper into his role as the Demon King. And I actually laughed again when the quote, "If a Demon King's triumphs are measured in screaming children being led out by the hand." I laughed at his measures of success. And once again, we see that Cabal judges from very different paradigms and perspectives.
Curry asking him to tone it down a little bit, but not much. Less bladder emptying terror.
Just tone it down a little for the kids, right?
You scared the little tyke shitless. Bless him. All right. And this is supposed to be like Mother Goose.
Like a children's theater. Like, this Faust is, for toddlers?
Yeah, well, exactly, right? Like, this is...
I find Cabal lacks social... Mm-hmm. Like that sort of social understanding.
Like I said, he locks himself into a narrative and that's that. There is no change. This is the way that is going to be done now. So he does find a bit of a friend in the Mr. caretaker. Pensy. Yeah, of the establishment. He does kind of all the odd jobs, handyman, caretaker, and most importantly to Cabal, records keeper.
Yes.
And he has a very meticulous record filing system, which is all the better for Cabal.
I love the way Jonathan L. Howard describes characters. I have to say, just love it. Like, for Mr. Pensy, like, looks like a reptile from a Nordic tale with his briar pipe smoking around him. Like, that was a beautiful imagery.
Always insultingly.
And even... Curry looking to be like a shaved panda.
Again, visual storytelling, visual, right?
This is beautiful. Very comedic. I like it.
Totally.
Yeah, and even the action of Mr. Pensy, of him turning to face him and look back at his things and then turning back, reminded me somehow of a dead man twisting on a rope. Very creative ways of going through the descriptions for these characters.
Well, you get the view, the insight into the workings of Cabal's mind, where it's meant as a compliment, but it's actually kind of dark and, you know, like shaved pandas. Like, who thinks like that? Who thinks in descriptions like that?
I mean, even with the description, I can't imagine that. Like, I don't know what I'm supposed to be thinking of right now. Yeah, like
I'm thinking, what are those called? Gummy bears?
What are those things again? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is still a great way to think about that character.
Right?
Like a gummy bear.
Like a gummy bear. Okay.
So, having figured out this pattern, having found that there is someone keeping records, he wants to go back 2,300 days before the first death. Mm-hmm. Figure out what happened the first time, right? And we are introduced to, let me say this, yeah.
Maleficarus the Magnificent.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that's how you say it.
Maleficarus? I don't know.
Maleficarus?
I have no idea. I don't speak Latin.
So anyways, that guy, clearly, you know, bit of a name to begin with. And turns out that he had a magic show, was of infamy of him, of his own, of being a performer of really grand tricks that, like, no one could figure out. And again, even, like, Mr. Pensky is saying, he's like, I see all the inner workings and I couldn't figure out how the hell he was doing his shit. So, this magician has gone and built the stage up for his own purposes. Mm-hmm. He's invested his own money in order to perform these tricks that he's wanted to defy and amaze and et cetera, one of which is this trap door, which, you know, as we learned at the beginning of the story, caused head splattering cave in. Boomf. And essentially speaking, it's pretty easy for Cabal to be like, all right, evil doer died and cursed the place. News at 11. Like,
next step, something TBD.
Totally, yeah. So something went down. Dude died in the middle of his trick and was like, cursed the whole building. And now every 2,300 days, something goes on.
Right. He figured that the magic that he had been invoking had followed him and taken its toll, is what his original theory was Mr. Magnificent.
Yes.
Real hard time to pronounce his name.
Well, and so much must be said about the name itself. Like, Maleficarus, what is it? Malleus Maleficarum is actually the name is reference to the book.
Yeah, and it's a real book. I actually did a little bit of research on that. First, Cabal refers to it as the endlessly amusing idiot's guide to the Inquisition. And the Malleus suggests torture to effectively obtain confessions and the death penalty as only certain remedies against the evils of witchcraft.
Mm-hmm. And actually, historically, the Malleus Maleficarum was used in, I believe, both Europe and the United States. During the witch trials, as he says, the idiot's guide to the Inquisition.
How charming.
I actually read it in high school. I actually read it in high school and we were doing a play called The Crucible. Mm-hmm. And it was my teacher who kind of convinced me to do a little deeper research on the history of it all. And I didn't read the ye olde English version, but more of sort of a sanitized, updated version. Well, not sanitized, but updated version. Mm. And it's clinical and dark, but, you know, very informational and instructional.
Right.
Should you wish to burn witches.
Right. And if you want to know a little bit more, I did do a little bit more research and did a post on necromancers.ca. So you can find out more if you'd like to read about that.
So anyways, moving on from all of this, Cabal, who knows his necromancy and has presumably read maybe The Crucible or The Idiot's Guide, et cetera, was aware of this. And, pretty much instantly says this guy was fucking around and, you know, got his comeuppance.
Yeah.
Essentially speaking, you know, it's a hazard of the job. You don't have all your PPE lined up. These things happen.
Always be aware.
Just another OSHA violation. In the grand scheme of necromancy.
I just had to say, I love this other little moment here. There's going back to Cabal describes theater folk as indeed a superstitious crew, not to say vain, stupid, and unhygienic. But then immediately after, we get Pensy, who describes the word paradigms. To him, paradigms, sir, conceptual frameworks from the Greek para, meaning beside or beyond, and deknina, meaning to know. Apparently, our Pensy is well educated for an uneducated theater man. So I like that little that sort of comparison. Like, not everything that Cabal thinks is true. We've got a theater man that knows his Latin as well,
right? Is that the part where it says nothing good comes out of combining Greek and Latin? Is that later?
That was actually in the last book.
Was it? Oh my god! Okay, see, I'm melding things already. I thought that was funny.
No, he was saying that that Maleficarus, when he was in the back of the wings, couldn't figure it out, and it really just shifted the paradigms.
Right.
And so he was like, paradigms? And he gets schooled. All right, youngster. Young theater.
Mansplained Latin. Yeah.
He took it well.
Totally. So I've got here that he retires to his dressing room, separate from all other performance, as described earlier, or all other performers, rather. And yet he feels the presence of the demon summoned by Maleficarus. And either it wanted to show me something or it wished me harm. Even the latter case would teach me something about it. And I thought this is where we get into a little more of the intent, the character development as well in Cabal, where it's like he wants to learn. His prime motivator is knowledge.
Yeah, and I don't even take it as him being like a daredevil, you know, like hit me, baby. It is just very much like I'm here to learn.
Yeah.
One way or another, I'm going to figure it out.
Totally.
Absolutely.
And it's like, I love from that, it's like Cabal's perspective on the potential conflict and antagonist, right? It's like, it's not a huge problem. It's an opportunity to learn more, mm-hmm. you know? So that I dug big time.
That moment there when the door opens, I thought it was really interesting description because it sort of lacked the, for being a ghost story, lacked those stereotypical presence of the ghost. Quote, there was no drop in temperature, no feeling of ease, no warning at all, and clearly, nor was there anybody on the other side of the door. And I kind of wonder if that was specific from Jonathan L. Howard to establish that it wasn't necessarily a ghostly presence that was there, but something else.
Mm, otherworldly.
Right.
That's potential, especially because I think, you know, the Cabal world hasn't really been established yet either for what is and isn't. As we've already seen, a lot of things are on Cabal's plane that are not normal, right? Yes. So I think it does help to establish that.
The Never-Never England?
Again, Never-Never England. Yeah. Just it intrudes it just a little bit more, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm.
Then it moves into the prop store description. Again, we get back into more sort of that visual storytelling. And I wrote here, hodgepodge of awesome randomness. Like, the author really just paints the scene.
Oh, yeah. Know? Right down to the items that are in there, like set a specific tone. I had to look up a couple of the stories that were referenced in there, like the... What, like, there were things that I recognized. Sweeney Todd's barber chair. So the demon barber of butcher of Fleet Street.
The Yorick in a jar. I laughed at that. Only because I remember back when I was in theater, we had a little rubber skull that we'd toss around calling Yorick Ball.
But the Duchess of Malfi's lover hanging from the ceiling. That one I had to look up. Huh. Are you familiar with that one?
No.
According to Wikipedia, because I have been Wikipedia crazy lately.
Deep dive.
The play begins as a love story when the Duchess Mary is beneath her class and ends as a nightmarish tragedy as her two brothers undertake their revenge, destroying themselves in a process. Jacobean drama continued the trend of stage violence and horror set by Elizabethan tragedy. Basically, it's been coined among the greatest tragedies of English Renaissance drama. Ooh. So he picks like these dark.
This theater plays. Is like a dark place. Like, I want to know if this place like also has like unicorn costumes shoved in the basement. Cabal just doesn't care to mention them. Like,
that was a different props room.
Yeah, well, and it is said earlier on that like this. The role that he has taken on as the Demon King was a little bit cursed. People were afraid of it. People were giving him a wide berth simply for the fact, why would you take this cursed role, you know? Like, and that, you know, again, they've given him this, like, change room that's away from everyone else. It's in the basement away. It's in part because that's where his entrance onto the stage is from underneath the stage. But at the same time, it's also just, like, a little bit other. So, again, this whole, like... And also, like, before this prop room, he ran to get a lantern, and the batteries were dulled in this presence downstairs anyways. Mm. Potentially, they were dulled already, but, again, he comes down, and he finds that the lantern isn't much help regardless, and it's very much like Cabal's present himself. I don't know if it's just, like, how the necromancy thing affects this world, but it seems that he himself just always has that little bit of a turn on the, you know, light. It's like he himself adds a dimness. Again, like, he insults everyone he meets. He has a bad opinion of everyone, a bad description of everyone, right? And again, when he comes down to this prop room and he only points out all of, like, the skull and the macabre and... Did I say that right? I don't know. Point is that, again, is there, like, a unicorn and pom-pom sitting in the corner that he just
doesn't notice
and care to speak on? Or are they really not here in this case? Like... It's hard to know with this guy. Unreliable narrator to an extent of, It doesn't fit my deep, dark, mysterious narrative, so I will not mention it.
Well, no, I'm curious to see that in the future, because how you said mm-hmm. that the story starts into the first-person narrative, mm-hmm. if we see in some of the other books, when it's third third person.
Yeah.
If that still maintains.
Like, mm-hmm. Jonathan L. Howard is a very well-balanced individual, but the minute he puts on the Cabal blinders, it all becomes a little darker.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I mean, like you said, there's room for growth.
Yeah.
Totally. So yeah, it's just it's a fun journey to take with him.
Totally. And I think that darkness does attract darkness, right? Like, mm-hmm. who else? Like, if you're a happy, chappy kind of person, you're not running into demons on the daily.
Yeah, know? And I mean,
so there's some dark
shadows attract shadows. Exactly. Yeah. You know, monsters aren't hiding in like the middle of a flower field, right? Oh. They're going to be in the alleys to begin with because that's where they blend in.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was talking about earlier on too, with like my attraction to the character being semi-dark, semi-flawed, but at the same time, like, his intents are noble? Question mark? You know?
He's very driven.
Yes.
Totally, yeah. Like, again, as long as all in the pursuit of education, really. I mean, he gets the job done, but it's, you know, his version of done is not necessarily what the rest of us relate to, you know?
Right. Back to the props room. So the door shuts on its own. The torch dies out completely, and Cabal is plunged into darkness and then confronted by a voice, a sibilant, inhuman voice. I liked the use of sibilant.
I don't even know what that word means. Sibilant?
A sibilant is... That's a sibilant. It's an S sound.
Oh.
And I, oddly enough, learned that by editing podcasts.
The more you know.
Right?
Insert rainbow banner.
And it's very impressive since the word that it's pronouncing is Cabal.
And it said that it's on a vowel, which, so the S, the hissing noise is on a, the human voice can't actually
do it.
Mm-hmm. I, you know, but I really want to try. As we all into the microphones. Sorry, audience.
No. We can do this, human. Okay? Keep trying.
We're determined to sound like demons. We are. Yeah.
Yes, so this is a very honestly funny moment. Go away, Cabal. Your path doesn't lie here, Cabal. Only death is here, Cabal. Like, damn, okay.
Cabal's just like, is it?
Yeah.
Huh. How?
Oh. Yes, perhaps it is a character flaw, but I hate being ordered around without even an intro. I thought that was hilarious. Yeah. Like, I feel the same, buddy. You know, perhaps if you'd introduced yourselves, you can order me around afterwards.
Right. You know, like. But essentially, yeah, he's like, I refuse to accept warnings. I'm out.
I see no empirical evidence of this being a proper warning. Yes. So I'm going to have to decline.
You didn't file the necessary paperwork. Come back next week.
I don't know much about social decorum, but I'm pretty sure this is not it.
So essentially he gets his threat. Says, I refuse to be threatened. I haven't learned enough yet. And sets off to, really, honestly, just see how this plays out.
Mm-hmm. So this concludes our episode 2.1, Pantomime. Thank you for listening. You can find us online at freeflowrambling.com and necromancers.ca. There we have links to our other podcasts, social media, and other fun tidbits. Please subscribe if you like what you're hearing, and please consider supporting us through Patreon to keep the undead alive and to see more content. We are Free Flow Rambling, and remember... Reanimation is trending.